Welcome to something that we've not done for a while, or I've not done for a while. Maybe somebody else has, but we used to call it the Esk podcast. Not sure what to call it now. The Paul Quinn podcast, perhaps. A great friend of mine, Richard Watts, is with me. Richard, you and I have spoken before on different podcasts at different times. Normally when Everton were in some form of disastrous set of circumstances, or when we were trying to garner support for whatever it was that we were protesting at the time. I feel as if we're not quite in those circumstances currently, but perhaps we're not quite in the circumstances that we hope we might be. First of all, welcome, and it's nice to see you as well as hear you on this occasion. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you, Paul. I mean, you and I got to know each other a bit through working on, you know, our shared frustration about the way the club was being run under its previous ownership. And, you know, as we talked, you know, having been to a couple of matches together this season, we thought, well, you know, why don't we do something at the end of the season to sum up how we think everything has gone. And for whatever, your introduction reminded me that it's really important to say, actually, for whatever the frustrations that we may end up expressing in this podcast, nothing compares to the level of existential danger that Everton was in when we, and for many, many other people who frankly put more time in, certainly than I did, into our work to protect the club we all love, was genuinely at risk of not even being anymore, certainly not being there in a shape any of us would recognise. So it does actually feel nice to be a more normal football club again and to have more normal football problems rather than being a football club in grave danger of plummeting.
I suppose the counter argument to that is, whenever has an Evertonian's expectations been normal?
That's right. And I think we should never have an expectation to be a normal football club. And I think, as we're going to go on and talk about this year, the fair test of this season was always going to be, what is the progress we have made from the position the Friedkin Group found on, sake of argument, 1st of January 2025, when they meaningfully took control of the club, started very quickly and I think very competently to reorganise club finances, to refinance the club, to make sure the new stadium could be completed, all the very basics that needed to be done. Our aspiration of Evertonians is always our motto, is to be the best, is never to be average. And for me, the question is, and the thing I think we will come on to judge this season on, is what's our, like, how much progress have we made towards being one of the best teams in the country? Because our motto should really mean something.
I mean, it is interesting. It is a good point to make that we've come a long way in a short time. I suppose the counter argument is that we've got nowhere near where we hoped we might be. And that might be, those expectations might have been slightly unrealistic, given where we started from and the relatively short period of time. But there is a feeling that we sort of left an awful lot on the, from my perspective at least, that we left an awful lot on the table at the end of the year. And it was a slightly unusual year. And I know you've done quite a bit of analysis, and maybe we'll get into that in a few minutes. It's a slightly unusual year in the sense that there was an opportunity for a club that perhaps might not have got into that position to get into a position where it could qualify for Europe. I think that's probably the limit of our expectations at this moment in time. And that's part of the frustration, isn't it, that we put ourselves in a position in a league that possibly European qualification this year was easier than it might have been in previous years, and yet somehow failed to do it right at the end.
I think that's absolutely right, Paul. And as we may come on to talk about, we got, 3 points from our last seven games. When we went into that ludicrously long international break at the end of March, having just thrashed Chelsea, genuinely thrashed Chelsea at home, I think we, all of us thought, hold on, this is, like, there is a real opportunity in the way this season has panned out for a unusually low number of points to get you into Europe, and there's an unusually competitive number of teams. That, I think that was an accident. I think there are structural reasons in the Premier League about why that may happen. And I think this may not be a freak season. I think that some of that may carry on, because one of the things we think we've seen in the Premier League this season is the middle ranking clubs, which I think we can now say Everton are part of, and that is that we couldn't have said that 3 years ago, are far more competitive now that with the most of the top six than they have historically been, that there are very, very few badly run clubs now in the Premier League, and the ones that stick out, and I'm thinking West Ham, have paid a very, very heavy price for that, as Everton were when we were a genuinely badly run club a few years ago as well. The question, I suppose, for me, and I think let's get into it, is, are we a well-run club? Have we really maxed out the progress it was realistic we could have made this season? I suppose that from my point of view, and trying to think about, like we're all committed Evertonians. We all feel enormous emotion about all of this, and me, like you, like anyone, many of the people listening to this, their mood in the entire week is driven by how well Everton do at the weekend. But trying to take that level of emotion out of it, I started off by thinking, well, what was actually par? What was a reasonable performance for Everton this season? Started off thinking, well, actually, the thing people in football usually say is your wage bill is your par performance. I haven't seen money. It's very difficult to get hold of figures for this season, but I think we finished last season, according to whatever websites they are. And there's a fair degree of inaccuracy around all of this. You have to take these figures with a bit of a pinch of salt, of saying we had finished last season with the 12th highest wage bill in the division. Deloitte Money League said our turnover was the 11th highest in the league, somewhere between Brighton and Crystal Palace, to put that in some context, again, on last season's accounts. That feels to me, that 11th, 12th, just under mid-table, felt to me like a reasonable par position. Now, we ended up finishing, was it 13th or 14th? I can't remember. And so we finished,
13th.
Yeah, 13th. Yeah. We sort of finished at the around that position. But you're right, Paul. Like, it didn't need that much more for us to have finished in a to do what Sunderland did and unexpectedly qualify for the Europa League, which is financially like a very big deal for the club, and would really have kicked us on. I think my argument when I started looking at the data is the reason we didn't do that isn't bad luck. It's some quite deep footballing reasons. And we were, in the end, yes, doing this podcast after that Chelsea match in late March would have felt very different. But actually, it would have been a wholly misleading impression of actually how fundamentally good we were as a club, and where we finished was kind of where we deserved to finish when you look at the underlying data. And that is really how what the iron law of football kicked in, which is ultimately clubs are very, very likely to regress to their underlying expected goals for and expected goals against data. And I did a bit of the digging on what there is. I mean, we've got 49 points on the pitch this season compared to 48 on the pitch for the last two seasons, taking account the points deduction 2 years ago. Actually, our underlying performance, our XG performance, was worse this season than it was for either of those 2 years. We created almost 50 expected goals, which is a bit up from creating almost 47 season before. We conceded 60 expected goals, which is well up from just over 53 the season before. Our expected goal difference is actually worse than that. I mean, Kevin Thelwell, I don't think he was right, but that's ultimately the best test of a team's quality. It was actually even worse, like both of those seasons were actually even worse than the underlying data in 23-24, because we so hot, because of DCL and a couple of others, so horribly underperformed our finishing, that our performance on the pitch is actually significantly worse than our underlying data. So when you actually look at the metrics that football professionals, at least, and I don't claim to be one of those, really think determines the quality of a season, we've now got worse three seasons in a row, and Significantly worse, actually. And I think that does start to underline that for some of the perceptions of progress and the fact that, yes, we were playing in a more competitive division this season than we were in the previous. You just didn't have the same number of bad clubs at the bottom who were easy sources of points. We have not made a great deal of progress this year. And I think you are right, like just objectively, any start of an analysis should needs to start on the point that our performances on the pitch are certainly no better, and actually in some ways measurably worse than they were last season, and both seasons worse than the season before that under Dyche.
Absolutely. I mean, it is interesting. And you did some analysis, and there's a document here which I'll tidy up and we can share it with the podcast later. I separately had done some analysis, which I published on my website. And actually, there's almost an argument. And I think if I was sitting in the boardroom at Everton, or if I was perhaps one of the Friedkin's representatives, I'd point to there's almost an argument for saying that we outperformed. I don't subscribe to that, obviously, and I don't think any other Evertonian would. But if you wanted to be defensive about where we ended up in the season, given the resources that were available to us, both financially, but I think particularly looking at the individual characteristics of the players that we had available to us, we slightly outperformed what might be expected of us. And I suppose the question then is, well, look at the players who we had available
Right.
to us. Did we always use the right players at the right time in the right formation? Because the manager has to play a role in this, and I don't want this, and I don't think it will be, to necessarily be a David Moyes bashing session, which has become very popular in recent days. But there is a question mark, I think, as to how well the club has been, what resources have been available to us, how well those resources have been managed through the season, and indeed through individual games.
I think that's 100% right, and the we've clearly spent a lot. We spent for Everton a lot of money last summer. The 140 odd million pounds we spent last summer was not a lot in Premier League. There's a lot of clubs outspent us last season, including again middle class clubs of the Brightons, etc., who clearly their excellent transfer dealings over many years has put them in a position to still significantly outspend Everton. But we spent a fair bit on players. I think Dewsbury Hall, Jack Grealish, when for the half of the season he was fit, clearly added talent to our attacking team. I think Ndiaye dropped off horribly, I think just through exhaustion at the end of the season. He's obviously a very good player. So our attacking numbers, our attacking data was a fair bit better than last season. Our defensive numbers, though, were significantly worse. And that's, I can't help but come to it. We've got some, there are, there, again, there are some numbers on this I'll come to in a second. So that's simply due to the lack of talent we have in defence, particularly when Branthwaite is injured, as he was for concerningly for large chunks of the year. And what is interesting is that for 3 years in a row, for the seasons I've looked at, each year we have conceded less than we should have done from the chances we conceded. And I think that's simply because we've got an excellent goalkeeper. But we have not been a good defensive team now for a number of years. And there's no sugarcoating that. Aaron Barton, I don't want to claim it's credit work where it's done by other people. Aaron Barton posted a table on X a couple of weeks ago that shows we concede 40% more goals with Kieran Tarkowski as our centre back pairing than with any other pairing. That's a lot. That's meaningful. And I think again, many Evertonians' deep frustration as the season really tailed off was persisting with a back four that is clearly not working and conceding a lot of goals as a result. And the data, the data, I, the data backs that up. And I think we certainly, I think we've got the worst fullbacks, I would argue, of any of the non-relegated teams, possibly worse than some of the relegated ones as well. I don't, I can understand in a season really dominated by set pieces why you want to keep a lot of really tall, strong guys on the pitch. And O'Brien is 6 foot six, Mikulenko's 6 foot one. They're both clearly decent defenders. I think O'Brien is actually a very good centre back. I think O'Brien is our best fit centre back when Branthwaite is injured. But in terms of attacking play, they offer almost nothing. And actually, fullbacks, I did some digging, and according to Data MB, a website called Data MB, of the players in the tops of all the fullbacks in the top seven European leagues, Mikulenko was on the 16th percentile, e.g., he was, one of the worst fullbacks against competition in leagues far, many of which are all of which are actually far worse than the Premier League for expected assists. James O, you know, O, Jake O'Brien was on the first percentile, e.g., 99% of other fullbacks in the top seven leagues in Europe. Create more expected assists than he did. So we are off getting absolutely nothing going forward from our fullbacks, and and I think you could see that. And part the joke a number of people made when the Southampton Spygate drama played out was, and we were playing Spurs at the weekend, obviously, one of the most important fixtures in Spurs' entire history. Were they tempted to spy on Everton? No, because all of us could tell you Moyes' chosen lineup and tactics for weeks in advance, and it didn't need professional Premier League analysts to go and try and figure out what Everton were going to do. And part of that, I think, was a deep frustration at carrying on with a back four lineup that was clearly not working as a defensive unit and was equally offering absolutely nothing in attack to compensate for that.
Very, very much so. But then the question has to be, well, what's the cause of all that? We know that there were personnel issues and obviously in injury issues. But, well, the obvious question is to ask, why did David Moyes persist with the personnel that he chose in the positions that he chose and the tactics in which he deployed?
I think there's two answers to that. I don't want to. I've never met David Moyes. I don't want to propose to speak for him or pretend I know his mind. But
No.
looking at this from the outside, I think there is both. Well, what Moyes said in his press conference is he still thought that that was the lineup that was best able to get the results he wanted, is what he said after the Spurs match when pressed by the excellent Joe Thomas of The Echo on, I think asked him some
Yeah.
very, hot. Hard but fair questions on this, which I don't think he responded well to. I think my view as a interested amateur and no more is that by that point it must like by the time that the season had really started to tail off, it became pretty clear what we were doing wasn't working, and where's the risk therefore in trying to change? Because like it's not like there was a great deal of advantage in just sticking with that same back four that we played almost all the season. But I think actually something like the fundamental thing, if we're going to analyse David Moyes as a manager, his defining characteristic is caution. And his caution in team selection, his caution in tactics, and his caution in transfers. And I don't think that's ever going to change. I think Moyes is therefore what you might term a high floor, low ceiling manager. He's never, David Moyes is going to deliver you results from a pretty predictable, pretty consistent style of play using a pretty conservative tactics and a pretty unchanging formation, set of personnel choices that will probably deliver you enough results that you will be, any club that employs him will be pretty free from risk of relegation, that will probably get you a decentish mid-table position. What there is never going to be, I don't think, and I think Moyes is now respectfully old enough that he ain't going to be changing anytime soon, ever, is a kind of taking risks, is taking approaches, is doing some of the kind of things that I think other clubs have done massively to their advantage this season, in all elements of a manager's job.
Yeah, and I accept entirely that premise. I mean, clearly he is a cautious manager, and he takes the view that you start off the game with a point, and that's the worst that should happen to you. Ideally, obviously, that's never the case. But there's a counter argument to the idea that that's consistently been his view, and that's consistently, therefore, his performance. Because if you break down the season, and it's unfortunate it is. In the final seven games, we conceded nearly 1.9 goals. If you look at, for example, the goals conceded after the 75th minute, the first 29 games, we conceded only goals in only five of those games, but we conceded 10 goals in the final eight games. So big, big differences. All of our clean sheets came in the games before the Chelsea game, not afterwards.
Yes, and you broke up slight there, Paul, but I think that's 100% right. And it goes back, actually, ultimately, bottom line is I think we had a bunch of players who, by the end of the season, were knackered. Again, I don't want to claim credit for what I'm about to say, because this research was done by Matt Jones, who posted it on X, not me. But the points he made, and he's 100% right, is look, Everton, and I think this comes into a question about, have we really used our squad to the best, to its full extent this season, which comes back to one of the bottom line tests for the whole year, which was, has the squad developed well enough? Well, I think the evidence is it hasn't. Everton were used the fewest players and the fewest subs of any team in the division. We had eight players who played more than 2,500 minutes this season, which is more than anyone else. There's Pickford, Tarkowski, Keane O'Brien, Mikulenko, Dewsbury Hall, Garner, and Ndjai. So all of that back four that was so struggling for much of, that was the one that conceded more goals than any other partnership. And players including Dewsbury Hall, Ndjai, and Garner to a degree, whose performances I think really dropped off at the end of the season. And I think the obvious reason for that is they were knackered. And if you add into that the AFCON, Senegal getting to the final of the AFCON for both Gay and Jai, then that's a lot of minutes. And it's no wonder their performances dropped off. We also play in a pretty tiring way. We put in the most duels of any team. We've contested the most duels of any team in the league. And I just think the squad ran out of gas. And that's where the question, I think, comes in about, well, did we use our squad? And we spent £42 million this summer on Tyler Dibbling and Adam Asnou, both very highly rated young players when they arrived. Asnou, I don't think, played in the league at all. Dibbling, I think, started two games and was a late sub and was taken off early in one of them, was a late sub in a couple of others. And, there was other players like Harrison Armstrong when we called him back from loan, who then barely played. Merlin Roll, who we got in and then didn't play a great deal. And we should properly look at whether we got any squad development at all this season or not, because that really was one of the key tests for me for this season. But I think the caution in team selection in the end came back to really bite us on the backside.
Absolutely. I mean, all the evidence is there, both just watching the game as a spectator, but then if you look at the underlying data, and to support the idea that the majority of the team who played the majority of the minutes just ran out of gas towards the end of the season, and maybe it isn't just as simple as that, that those players were completely overutilized. And football is a game of relative measures as against absolute measures, and just perhaps on a relative basis, we were always destined to underperform at the end of the season, given that's the approach that Moyes has taken. I suppose the other bit of evidence that in the case against David Moyes would be that West Ham performed very similarly in his final season at West Ham.
I think that's right. And I think, and we have seen many similarities, I think, and I want to come on to talk about one when we talk about transfers, between what Moyes did at West Ham and what Moyes' tenure at West Ham was an enormous success. And one only has to look at, in many ways, they won a major trophy, and blimey, we want one of those at Everton. And, if Moyes could do that, his tenure would be like if Moyes had won the Europa Conference League, a lot of other failings would be forgiven. That would be an incredible season for the club. But he also inherited a world-class talent from his academy in Declan Rice, and you don't do that very often. What's also interesting, though, is actually a bit like his first tenure at Everton. He did some really good, smart buys that propelled the club on. But actually, and this comes back to a thing we should talk about around transfers, w the more control he had, actually things started to go wrong. So the signing of Jarrod Bowen, who the club talked a lot about wanting Premier League experience in the players he got. I don't think Jarrod Bowen had any Premier League experience. I think he gets West Ham signed him direct from Hull for not a lot of money. He felt very similar to some of the signings actually Moyes made in his first tenure at Everton, whether it's Tim Cahill. Who had no Premier League experience, came straight from the Championship. Mikel Arteta, who played for Rangers, some of the brilliant signings, like the world class signings that Moyes made in his first tenure, or like Leighton Baines or Phil Jagielka, who'd had maybe a season or two of Premier League experience, but in very poor teams. And part of that caution and around transfers of wanting quotes. Premier League proven players means for me that we were never going to get the kind of you're always shopping in a very expensive market, and it's much harder to find the kind of bargains that other clubs have found. And just to make one comparison, Bournemouth spent 28 million pounds on two fullbacks in Adrian Truffaut and Alex Jimenez, albeit I know there's like very serious allegations made about Jimenez, but putting that to one side, both of whom absolutely transform that club's ability at fullback. We spent 35 million pounds on Tyler Dibling that we got under 200 minutes out of this season. If we got Truffaut and Jimenez instead of Dibling, we would be in the Europa League. We would actually have been challenging for the Champions League.
Again, just another piece of evidence to I really dislike saying the sort of the anti-Moyes case, but just questioning Moyes' performance and the contribution that he made to the season as a whole. I mean, but it has to be more than just David Moyes, I think. I think in terms of I think we have to look at this from a wider perspective, and yes, we said at the beginning of this podcast, look where we came from, but that doesn't excuse perhaps the conditioning of the players. It doesn't excuse perhaps the injury record. I think we had the highest number of soft tissue injuries in the league this season. It doesn't explain that we tend to start the seasons very slowly. So if you cast your mind back to last summer, in pre-season friendlies, we looked completely undercooked compared to the teams that we were playing. And this seems to be a characteristic of Everton teams in recent years, not just with David Moyes. I think we could go back for a number of years and say that. So perhaps we need to look at our training, perhaps we need to look at the medical teams, perhaps we need to look at our conditioning, our coaching, and we might reach the conclusion that actually everything that we're doing now is better than anything that we've ever done at the club before, and that might be the case. The question, though, is, and I'll go back to using the word, it's comparative. Have other teams been able to do more with their resources than we're able to do with ours? And I think that's the same way you start then to ask questions of the leadership within the club. So are they making this form of analysis, and are they prepared to make any changes if indeed the analysis shows perhaps what I'm suggesting?
So that has to be right. In the end, so for me, things like training, medical staff, like the football operations, the question is who is responsible for that. I think the current structure at Everton, albeit the lack of transparency about this, I don't think is very helpful. I think in the end, at Everton, though, those are currently David Moyes' responsibility. We don't have a director of football anymore. And I think they all of those things would, in the end, ultimately, certainly training and conditioning would sit under the manager's, under the manager's portfolio, in the manager's remit. The bigger question, though, around how are we using our resources, though, is ultimately one for the club. Did we get best value for the 140 plus million pounds we spent this summer? And it Well, I don't think many Evertonians, I don't want to speak for all Evertonians, but my own view, and I think many Evertonians, I think, would agree with this, is that we didn't. Going back to £43 million, we're up 200-ish Premier League minutes for Dibbling and Asnou in a really critical transitional season. The old joke that, in honour of Seamus Coleman, that we seem to have retired buying right backs, let alone his shirt number, is true, but we've been talking about needing new full backs on both sides for 4 or 5 years now, and that could not have been clearer actually as the season went on and as Branthwaite's in second injury hit. We're stuck, as I say, with Jake O'Brien is our only mobile and certainly our only fit mobile centre half, and I would argue our best fit centre half, still stuck at right back, contributing very out of position, contributing very little. And I the so I never understood why we were not prioritizing certain positions, like certain positions, particularly full backs in the summer. And I really don't understand. And I found it deeply frustrating personally why we didn't take the opportunity of the January window to, again, I think it was already very clear by January that whatever advantage we got from basically the surprise of chucking a 6 foot six guy in at right back we got last season, it kind of worked in places last season. The surprise element of that had completely gone this season, and we were already by January very clear that we're getting very little return from O'Brien at right back. Why we weren't didn't move for a right back in January, when there were some available, and the club, it is believed, had some money to spend, not lots, but enough to get in a decent fullback given the given market rates at the moment for them. And I think, the Branthwaite injury that then ruled him out for the whole of that run-in, I think really exposed the fact of how short, like the folly of not, at least not doing one relatively risk-free transfer in January, that I think would have had a disproportionate impact actually on the way we could have used our squad in the run-in. And it does come back to that real question. I think the jury's very much out on, which is, does the current structure work? The kind of so-called committee, is there real alignment between the manager, who still talks about wanting to get experienced players, the Premier League, Premier League proven, which is not a is a transfer approach I personally think I really is a transfer approach I really worry about. I don't think is the right one for Everton and a club in our current financial or league position, and a ownership and a like scouting team who clearly have also prioritised getting in younger developing talents who the manager, for whatever reason, hasn't seen fit to play or hasn't seen fit to play very, very much. And it doesn't look like from the outside like there's a clear alignment there. And from that, I don't think we did get great value for money for some of the signings we put in. And I think we could have got considerably better value for money had we taken the transfer approach of being a bit more risk averse in our transfers, of not looking for established, always looking for established Premier League players. And some of the teams around us in the division did, who I think probably did get better value for money. Every transfer is a risk, right? There's no such thing as a risk-free transfer. You look at KDH, bringing KDH, who I think was a good buy, because I think you always need value. For a club of Everton, do not have unlimited resources. Like very, very few clubs in the world do. Everton always need to find value, however defined, in their transfers. I think 30 million quid for Dewsbury Hall, who had the ability as a good age, prime age player with Premier League experience to hit the ground running. And a few players like that. I think Grealish clearly added a lot for the half a season he was fit. And we definitely noticed when he wasn't around, when he wasn't in the team anymore, I think. There was an argument for getting in some players like that. Balanced off against against getting some younger players in. And because ultimately Everton, there's one or two clubs in the whole world that aren't in a position where they need to sell players now and again. And Everton will always be in a club that needs ultimately to sell. Everton will likely always to be a club that will in the end need to sell players in the end for more than they bought them for, and or to squeeze value out of players where we think there's a market opportunity, like KDH as a player who could have gone for more than 30 million in the end we bought him for.
I mean on that last point, I think most football fans now recognize that the what used to be called sell to buy and was viewed as a negative is now just a necessity. There has to be rotation of the squad, and the squad at any one time is part functional in the sense that you've got the squad that you want to perform at the level that you want to perform at, but you've also got a view to the future because you know that you're going to have to dispose of players as assets and make a profit in order to buy players in the future. I suppose for me, and with your great organisational skills, I'm going to ask you quite a difficult question, but I'm sure you can answer it, is what is the structure that we actually need within the club, given that we've got an individual like David Moyes, who has obviously got his own firm opinions as to who we should recruit and then who should play and how we should play. Is he given too much autonomy? And at what point does somebody come in and say, actually, David, I don't think we're quite doing things the way we thought we were going to, or the way that we would like it to happen? Or indeed, does anybody like that exist at the club? Two entirely different questions, but I thought I'd put you on the spot.
Does Moyes have too much autonomy? It's difficult to know, given the structure that Everton use that is relatively unique in the Premier Division, as far as I could tell. There's a lot of clubs who use a quite traditional director of football model. Everton sort of used that under Kevin Thirlwell. And I actually, you and I have had this conversation before, Paul. And I know this is not a popular thing to say with many Evertonians. I actually think in the incredibly difficult circumstances he was operating in, Kevin Thirlwell did a good job. And we look back at the signings of Unjai, Garner, O'Brien, all for around the £15 million mark or less than. I think, blimey, they were good buys now. Because, they're all, if Branthwaite ever gets fit again, and please, please, I hope he does, they are three, probably our three most, aside from that, the point was certainly our three most valuable players now. And I think, that is absolutely the model for what, for the kind of player we should be trying to go for, in my view. But we don't have that director of football model. We've got this, apparently this committee, this relatively flat structure, appointing to Angus Kinnear of, some people have no doubt, they've got very, very impressive CVs in scouting, in data analytics, in, and David Moyes is part of that. And David Moyes has said himself, he has final say on any transfers. What I think we are, it does feel to me, and I don't claim any insider knowledge at all about this, but it feels to me as an interested observer that there is a tension between the kind of players David Moyes wants to buy, who are your KDH's, Jack Grealish style, finished product, versus the kind of players who the club would be pushing for, who are younger players with more value. And that, I think, feels like the risk, the risk of a lack of alignment, which I think can lead to you spending a lot of money on players who don't play, who the coach doesn't, the coach doesn't want to pay, even though he's, very clearly, he's publicly said he has final sign off on all of them. How much did we need, like, an alternative left back at times this season? We spent 8 million quid on one of a very highly rated Bayern Munich product in Adam Asnou, who we must have scouted. We can't not have scouted. We are a professional operation these days, and yet we're told he simply wasn't physical enough to play in a Premier League where there has actually been a very significant shift to much more physical play in the last couple of years. But we knew that before we bought him. So if we were really spending 8 million quid on a reserve right left back, what was Adam Asnou the right guy to get? And the suggestion is probably no, because if he's not fit to play, then he was then what then this wasn't the right season to get him. Same argument applies, I think, to Tyler Dibbling. I think we were left in a position midfield where it now feels like we've got an awful lot of players with very similar profiles between Harrison Armstrong, Timo Abunim, and Merlin Roll. None of them are bad players, actually, I don't think. All of them pretty good value for money. Obviously, Armstrong is our best academy product for a while, but not great transfer. Like, I slightly question the decision to bring in Merlin Roll, particularly given Timo Abunim's emergence as something better than what feels to me like the, PSR Dodge transfer that appeared to be at the time. Because I don't, I'm not sure. We don't quite have a really defensive six. We don't really have, apart from KDH, who's a runner, not a passer, a creative 10. We've got a whole bunch of players, of which James Garner, and we should say this, and I don't want to be fair in this podcast. The emergence of James Garner as an England squad quality player has been both a bit unexpected and a genuine plus from the season. But it does also expose that underneath him, we're actually really well stocked of central midfielders, all of whom feel to me to have a pretty similar kind of game. And we are now tied to an £18 million transfer, I think, for Merlin Roll, that frankly, I don't think I would now be making if we, given the way in which Harrison Armstrong and Timo Rabuna have come on this year.
Yeah, I suppose. I think if you and I are Everton supporters and we're just looking at this as, either some other club or some other business, wouldn't we be drawing a conclusion that there's not an overwhelming strategy here?
That's the real test, right, isn't it? And I can't see what that currently is, either actually for the team or really for the wider club. And I suppose, like, there's kind of bring some conclusions together around all of this. I'm really clear about what some club's strategy in the league is. I'm not very clear at the moment about what Everton's strategy is, and the way we are going to get significantly better in what will remain a very competitive Premier League, albeit with, I think, a few worse teams in it at the bottom that everyone will take more points off next season. That, if we're actually going to challenge Brighton and Bournemouth and those teams before we start getting into challenging the Villa, Aston Villas of this world, We need, you know, we need absolute clarity and alignment around what the strategy is, and ultimately a head coach who buys into that strategy. And it, you know, for me, like David Moyes felt the right appointment for the Friedkins to make at the point they took over, and Dyche clearly left earlier than they anticipated and left them in the lurch. That kind of l high ceiling, low f that kind of high floor, low ceiling coach for a club that last Christmas, Christmas 24, was it still in, was not a million miles away from being in a relegation battle again, where the club was in, the club is like exiting an existential crisis, where the owners had to get their feet under the table, had to do an awful lot off the field in the first few months just to stabilize club finances, finish the stadium, get the stadium move gone. 100% understandable to get a safer bet as is available. And I think David Moyes is that. I think we are now, I don't think we need a safe bet anymore. I think the And because I think we've now achieved at least a level of stability as a football club, both in financial and ownership. Stadium moves happened. I think the club broadly has handled that extremely well, by the way. I had the honour of being, like, my best mo personal moment of the season was actually being at the opening game against Brighton with my kids. And the stadium is wonderful. And there's inevitably been some teething problems. But as far as I can tell, the club has handled those really quite professionally and sensibly. And, lots of kudos. Lots of kudos should be applied for, for that, I think. And, the stadium will merge and stadium involved, but overall, the stadium move has been an enormous success given what could have happened. And in that context, like, I think we are now well set up to like be really clear now about what our footballing strategy is, and that requires a manager stroke head coach absolutely aligned with what the club owners' vision is, which at the moment does seem to be invested through Angus Kinnear as like chief executive and head of all operations, and a whole team that works to him, as opposed to a single director of football that owns the footballing strategy. Now, I think I recall Angus Kinnear saying his publicly his concern with that kind of approach is an awful lot of power and an awful lot of responsibility to put in one person if they were to leave. If they fail, then you're really in struggling as a club. But what we need to show with this different approach of actually having a team approach to that football leadership is that that team is aligned and that team has a clear football strategy. And we need to show that with whatever transfers this season, whatever the decision is on whether what with Moyes, where Moyes has got 1 year left on his contract, do we keep him? Do we extend him? Do we let drift? Do we drift into next season doing neither? Which for me would be the worst of the three available options. Or do we, and that has to be underpinned ultimately by an ownership decision about what actually is their level of ambition and what is their level of investment in Everton to achieve that ambition. And I think in the end, for every really successful club, including the Bournemouth, Brighton, Brentford, the B clubs, all of which is really driven by the owners. And for me, the question now is, what is the owner's, like, qu question I think to finish this podcast on is, what is the owner's ambition for next season, and are we well set up to deliver that? And I just don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I would agree totally with that final point. For me, the owners have to come out and have to establish, or they have to explain to us what their vision for the club is. They have to explain that if we're going to make major changes in personnel on the pitch during the summer, in whose vision are we going to create a new team? Is it going to be the committee and looking towards the future of the club? Or is it if, as David says, he has a high degree of control over recruitment. Is it going to be down the route that he would prefer us to go? And the two are going to be very entirely different. And of course, the other argument is, well, if you retain David Moyes as manager, but we still have a recruitment policy that's more driven by the sort of committee, more driven by the longer term vision, whatever that might be for the club. And he then chooses not to choose those players, even though we've recruited players over this summer. And that could be one of the stories of the last season, that we have recruited players, but they've not either not developed or they've not been used, we're unlikely to be in a very much better place this time next season than we are now.
I couldn't agree more with that. And in the context of the way in which middle-class Premier League clubs are now being run as some of the best football clubs in the like the most effectively run football clubs in the whole world, the quality of competition is getting higher and higher and higher. Because I can absolutely promise you that while every club makes mistakes in transfers, Bournemouth, Brighton, Brentford, some of those other clubs will have a very clear football strategy. It will be owned by the club's ownership. It will be driven all the way through the club, and they will there that gives them a higher chance of making higher quality signings and making progress on the pitch than clubs that aren't operating with that real degree of like strategy and alignment. And you've seen that. Ultimately, that's why West Ham have been relegated, was that they were made bad decisions. But actually, when you look at, again, when you look at some of the transfers that Moyes oversaw in his second period at West Ham, that feels to me the real risk of if you go with a manager-led win now strategy. So if all of the players you sign are in their mid to late 20s or even early 30s, because you think they're the players that can get you progress on the pitch next season, you've still got them when they're in their mid to early to mid 30s. Their performances are starting to fall off a cliff, and they're still tied on really expensive wage contracts that no one is ever going to take off your hands. And whilst clearly, I don't think West Ham would have got anywhere near relegation if David Moyes had still been their manager, because I think he's a good enough coach that he'd have got a better tune out of the resources than whoever their recent managers have been. I think part of the enormous problems they've got with the financially and with their wage bill comes from a manager having too much power to buy win now players who have just aged out while still on like enormously expensive contracts and have just become unshiftable. And that's why my argument is there's no such thing as, like, people describe Dewsbury Hall as a risk-free transfer. That's completely wrong in my view. Every time you buy a 26-year-old, you're taking a massive risk, because if they don't work out and you're stuck with them on a 4 or 5 year contract on big-ish wages, like any Premier League proven 26-year-old will be, that's a club-killing financial drain.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things you wrote about David Moyes' transfer strategy and performance at West Ham, and one of the things that I thought as a result of what you wrote was actually, to an extent, David Moyes was operating in a vacuum at West Ham because of their leadership problems and because of their own more, well, actually ownership problems, not leadership problems. And perhaps he was given again. Given too much autonomy, or given the opportunities to do things the way that he wished to do it, and that may not be the appropriate way to do it. And my concern would be that if we went into a second full season with David, and he's given that degree of autonomy over this summer, that we find ourselves in similar circumstances. I can't see how we end up if David was given free rein over the summer, and indeed if he demands free rein. I can't see how we end up being in a more competitive position at the beginning of the season than we're leaving this season in.
Well, the risk is we actually are in a slight. I think the risk is actually you get some short-term benefit from it because you're buying a whole bunch of peak-age players who actually aren't bad for the first year or two. The mess I think it really leaves you is in years 3 and 4, where those players are aging out, and you've still got them on very, very expensive contracts, and you're unable to shift them. But I think your basic point is right, that there's really two options, I think, for the Friedkins and like the senior decision makers at Everton faced this season. One of which is like to pursue a stability strategy while the club continues to build off the pitch, it continues to build its commercial thing, but you take an approach that says this is a slow build. We'll have a cautious manager. We're never going to get relegated with David Moyes in charge. And I think that's true. And we therefore build slowly. We restrain the worst elements of his instincts to by win now players with getting some younger players in, and we accept every so often there's going to be a misalignment and someone doesn't, we buy someone who in the end the manager doesn't pick, but we yeah and that yeah and that slow build is a way to go. That's clearly the off the pier purely commercially is an approach you can that is an approach you could take. I think there is a different approach, and it's certainly the one that I would prefer the club to go down, which is we try, which is we've come to a position where actually there is a core of decent players at Everton reaching their prime. A bunch of those Kevin Thelwell signings. We've still got a good number of years of Jordan Pickford as a exceptional goalkeeper. If Gerald Branthwaite stays fit in O'Brien and Branthwaite, I think we've got a potentially really good centre back pairing there. I think whilst Tierno, Barry and Beto have been much maligned, actually when you start to look at their data, they both haven't been bad players this season in the context of Premier League strikers, particularly Barry at 23, I still think has got a lot of potential. I know there's a immaturity both on and off the pitch, but there's a real player there in my view. I know it's probably a minority view amongst Evertonians, but for a Premier League striker to do what he did, having cost 27 million quid when strikers who got only slightly better records than him cost 75 million, like Šeško, then you are that was not a bad buy. There is a core of decent. There's a core. There's a real core there to build around, and I think if the club decided to go to spend a bit more money to take a somewhat more risky approach. And I think that does require real alignment through the club to deliver that. And my best bet at that point, looking at this from the outside, is that does require a different head coach to do that. And as it happens, there are some really exceptional ones currently unemployed and probably gettable by a club of Everton's potential. That is what I think we should. That's the approach I would. Like that's the approach I would as an Evertonian will want to see us take, which is take the risk to move on, given I think the quality of coach currently available, if the club were to move quickly, if a Glasner or an Iraola or someone like that, who I think are both gettable, then I think we could actually put ourselves in a position where we do make a real step forward next season, and use that as the position that in 2 or 3 years' time start to be genuinely competitive in that competitive fringe of clubs, looking for champion like high level Europa League, low, on the fringe, on the boundary between Europa League and Champions League qualification, and a couple of years in the Champions League really then starts to make us competitive, starts to give us the income level to be competitive for trophies. And that's where we want Everton to be. And it's that trajectory which is ambitious, but I think realistic with a well-aligned strategy, given our ground, given our stadium, given our income potential as a club, which knocks all of those other middle-class Premier League. We have the potential to grow beyond any of those other middle-class Premier League clubs, given the stadium, given the fan base. I think that's where that for me. Is making that decisive break forward is the thing I really want to see the club do, but I just think that needs ultimately isn't even an Angus Kinnear decision. That's a Friedkin decision, and the owners need to show the leadership to drive that.
Well said, Richard. I think that's an excellent summary of where we are and what we need to do. I am conscious of time because you have a fixed deadline. So should we leave it here and perhaps later in the summer, as the perhaps after the World Cup, as the transfer window develops, pick it up and maybe some of the things that you've just asked for will happen, or we may find ourselves with the current incumbents still in charge, and we can make an assessment of how it's going. I don't know, perhaps at the end, sometime in July, before the season gets underway.
Let's do that, Paul. I'd look forward to it.
Yeah, Great. Well, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for all of the research that you've done. I will put it together and stick it out with the podcast. And yeah, enjoy your summer and speak to you soon.
Bye now.
Thanks. Bye bye.